Hello, everybody. I'm John Atack, and this is Casey, who has no surname and lives at the cult vault. And
Hello.
yeah. So yeah, tell the nice children how you came to run the cult vault and why you keep cults in a vault in the first place. Best place for them, but.
Well, it's an interesting story. I'm sure I've probably told this one a few times, but I'll say it again. And
Please
thank you
do.
so much for having me back, John. I appreciate
Yeah.
sitting down to have these discussions. You have a very peaceful way about you, which is nice at the end of a very busy day.
We're going to do this show ASMR.
I'll just go get my what's it, soap slicer? My son watches videos of people slicing soap on YouTube, but
Sounds
that isn't
brilliant. I'd love
actually
to slice.
anything that isn't anything to do with cults as far as I know. At this point I wouldn't be
Ah,
surprised, but
don't you know?
if
He's already joined
anyone would
in.
know. So the Cult Vault podcast was a project that I started during lockdown. My son was only 4 months old. My partner was working 12-hour night shifts, and it was really tough to try and find something outside of motherhood, brand new mothering, and also not being able to access family, friends, support, play groups, and things. So as babies do, they sleep sporadically, and I found myself just going a little bit stir crazy in the house when he was sleeping. So I decided to start a project, which was a podcast, and I was going to go down the avenue of unsolved mysteries because I find that sort of stuff really interesting. And then my friend was reading Jenna Miscavige Hill's memoir and said, "You should look at cults because cults are really interesting." And I thought to myself, I do actually think that there's a fascination around cults. And my idea of the true crime genre, which I've spoken about quite a bit on my podcast at this point, was very different to how it is now. I think I consumed true crime media in a very unethical way, very detached from people's stories, very kind of desensitized to the fact that awful things were happening to people, their families were left scarred forever. And as I started looking into cults, it was kind of like a Dunning-Kruger thing. You think you've watched a documentary or two, and you think you have an idea of what a cult is. I still, to this day, I'm not sure that I even know, because the definitions vary so much, and everybody has a different idea of what a cult is. But as the show progressed, I began getting contacted by individuals who had left their own cultic environment. And I say it like that because I had individuals contacting me that had grown up in families that were quite authoritarian or cultic in nature, which was a new thing for me to even begin to understand, as well as individuals who were born and raised in various environments that also share the attributes of what constitutes a cult. And I realized at that point that my approach to true crime was questionable. I had a lot of work to do, a lot of reading to do, and a lot of work in educating myself. So here we are, 300 or so episodes later. Interviews with cult survivors, but also just survivors of all various types of experiences that you could look at and place inside of Steve Hassan's white model, for example, and say, you know, there are some earmarks within this experience that may result in the white model saying, you know, there's a chance you've been in a cult. A lot of my work is focused on the troubled teen industry, which again was something that I had no idea even existed. It's something that a lot of people in America think is a conspiracy theory because it sounds so outlandish. And as you begin to look into it, you realize that actually it is a million-dollar industry that does exist,
Tell
is thriving.
us something about that. The troubled teen industry.
So the troubled teen industry was born in some ways out of Charles E. Diedrich's Synanon, which was like a drug rehabilitation therapy cult in the 1970s.
It goes back before then. It goes into the 70s and you've got the famous rattlesnake in the mailbox, which is the thing I'll always remember them for.
Yes.
And poor man who was bitten by the rattlesnake, I think he's had to have blood transfusions every 2 weeks since that happened to him.
Yes, yeah. Paul Morantz, he recently passed away, actually. And I was drafting an email to him in my email box as well. So I mean,
that's incredibly inconsiderate of him to die just as you're about to talk to him.
It just shows you that if there's a person in the world that you want to speak to, you should just contact them. But Paul Morantz has left a huge legacy behind: his legal efforts, his writings, and his contribution towards understanding cults has been quite educational for me, because Synanon was one of the first groups that I really looked at in detail and trying to understand sort of like the kind of the etiology of Synanon and how its influences is still in the world today. And after speaking recently with Dr. John Hunter, whose interview with yourself I actually sat down to watch, a fantastic mind, one of the best, most brilliant minds, it really helped me to understand how large group awareness training complements the work of Synanon and the influence of Synanon in the troubled teen industry. So in America, primarily, there are institutionalized boarding schools, wilderness therapy camps, and programs where troubled teens, so children and young adults, are sent to attempt to rectify some type of behavior that is seen as difficult for parents or damaging to the young person themselves.
Sometimes called brat camps.
Yes, yeah, brat camps, boot camps. There's Christian versions. There's a hefty Mormon influence in some parts of America, as there is with all things Mormon in some parts of America. Mm-hmm. And within these boarding schools and wilderness programs, there's like a blueprint that's used where children and young people are detached from families, from guardians and loved ones, sent
isolate.
Typically,
step number one.
Completely isolated. So isolated in terms of moving them a number of states away, usually to, you know, a really far side of where they're normally located in terms of America as a country. And then it's isolation in terms of location, not just from loved ones. So yeah, these places will be in the middle of nowhere. You get kidnapped in the middle of the night by these people that are referred to as goons. So they're, you know, dressed in big black heavy boots, uniforms, coats. They come in the night, they take you out of your bed, they zip tie you or handcuff you, put you in the back of their car, and it's positioned to the guardians or the parents that this is what is best for your child. This is the only way that we can start your child's journey to a better life, better behavior. Without our help, they will end up dead, insane, or in jail, which is the name of a memoir by Zach Bonney. And Zach Bonney went to CEDU, which is a direct school that stands for the Charles E. Diedrich University. But they tried to say that it's nothing to do with Synanon. So
just accidentally has his name. It's a coincidence. Yeah,
The acronym that the CEDU representative said it actually stands for doesn't even make sense. So it's the Charles E. Diedrich University, and there's a number of different schools that use Synanon's game of screaming and shouting in people's faces, breaking people down for hours and hours and hours on end. This is seen in almost every single troubled teen facility across America. It will have a different name. You know, this loaded language that's used, that they'll have different terms for you know, being in check. So like a term for being within the rules of the facility itself. And the rules, of course, change because the goalposts in these groups never remain the same. Otherwise, there's a chance that you would be able to conform completely and, you know, be able to walk out when you're finished. And that's not the way these things are designed. So if you're not gooned in the middle of the night, there's a chance that your parents will drop you off and then just be told to leave. You know, don't linger, don't hang around. The quicker that you leave, the easier it is for your child if there's no long goodbye. And then it's the cavity searches, strip searches, anything, any type of clothing that's not of a certain color is taken away. Anything with branding on it, like if you had like an Adidas or a Nike jacket or something, that would be taken away.
Well, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. We don't want to be promoting them.
Headphones, you know, and they position this as trying to make sure that you're not bringing any sort of illicit substances onto the campus or wherever the place is located. So that's why the cavity searches take place, which doesn't make sense to me if you're taking a child through an airport with two people that have taken them in the middle of the night where they've actually had to go through searches that are designed to find, you know, and dogs and all sorts of security in airports that are designed to find people who can smuggle drugs in the most hidden of ways. And so
let's put it that way.
These,
this is something that women are better at than men, by the way.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. So these places really start off by giving what young people have described on my podcast, at least, as one of the most invasive, most horrific experiences possible. You know, without the kidnapping, the strip searches and the cavity searches are something that it is repeatedly said on the podcast has stayed with a person ever since the experience and long after they've left. So once
it's a form of rape. Let's be straightforward about it. It's a form of rape, and of course we'll leave a trauma. And any parent that thinks that it's a sensible idea to have your children traumatized to cure them, it's just a ridiculous idea. Stop it if you're out there doing it. Stop it right now.
It's really
meant to love and be nice to children, you know.
The reasons why individuals go to these places can vary as well. It can be somebody tries marijuana for the first time, or their grades are dropping in school, all the way through to somebody that has severe psychological ill mental health needs, and it goes to a place that cannot support them in the way that they need to be supported. The propaganda that is generated by these places will say that they can offer, you know, personalized therapy with qualified therapists. There'll be group therapy and family therapy, that there'll be great educational attainment for the residents that go through the programs. None of this turns out to be true most of the time. A lot of the people there that are offering therapy are not licensed practitioners. And a lot of individuals leave their program and find out that the certificate they're issued at the end of their tenure is not an equivalent of a GED or something that they can use to actually enroll into further education or get a job. So people find themselves having to go back to school, college, night classes to try and get some type of accreditation for employment prospects. And it is just harrowing, some of the isolation that people are placed in. There's a thing that a lot of these places use called mattress, where somebody is just told to stay on their mattress for months at a time, or silence restriction, like we've heard of with in the Children of God, where people aren't allowed to talk. They wear a sign around their neck saying, "I'm on silence," and no one's allowed to talk to them or make eye contact with them. There's, of course, as you can imagine, lots of labor trafficking. So the young people are responsible for the upkeep of the property, cutting down trees, laying driveways, gravel paths, and the the coat hangers have to be a certain amount of space apart. If you don't do these things, then you're not in check. If you're not in check, you accumulate points to be on silence restriction. So it kind of just builds this puzzle. Every single thing that's used within these troubled teen facilities builds a puzzle that comes together to create this kind of totalitarian system of individuals being horrifically abused, horrifically mistreated, and not able to reintegrate into typical society when they leave. Issues with oversharing because they've had these group therapy sessions where they're required to scream and shout at each other until they're sobbing or passing out. I mean, I could just go on and on, but it's a billion-dollar industry that profits off of the institutionalized abuse of young people. And there are certain pathways that are set up with some of these programs where judges will send children to troubled teen facilities instead of juvenile detention, or social workers will recommend teens to these facilities. And typically these places cost thousands and thousands of dollars a month. And it will start off with, oh, your child will stay for 6 months, but then they do something wrong, so they stay for 12 months. And who's footing the bill this entire time? Usually the family. So phone calls are monitored, letters are read if they come in the post. If you start to say anything to your parents, a lot of the time people have discussed their phone calls being cut off and then they're not allowed communication privileges for a certain amount of time. If they start to say things to their parents about wanting to come home or being mistreated, then the staff phone up the parents later on and tell them that their children are just trying to manipulate them. This is what they're really good at. We've seen this in the therapy sessions. And of course, this isn't true for every case, but these are generalized things that have come through in the interviews that I've done. 20 to 30 or so of them now on the podcast. So yeah, the troubled teen industry is a very real thing. And interestingly enough, Paris Hilton went to one of these schools and is the biggest advocate for change in and bringing awareness to this as an industry right now, which is interesting. And having a notable face at the helm of an entire kind of movement, or a whole demographic of individuals that are trying to get some type of systemic change, is having quite a profound effect. And so many survivors are coming forward now after resonating with what Paris Hilton has said in various documentaries about her experiences. So yeah, that's the troubled teen industry, tip of the iceberg.
Tip of the iceberg. Yeah. And I mean, I think we could fairly say that Paris Hilton was a troubled teen and that it didn't work for her or her friend Tommy, with whom she became famous on the internet long, long ago. And it's good when somebody who, you know, has had such a strange career turns around and says, I want to do something for the world. You know, I want to change something. You know, I must admit, I thought it was strange, the movie The Bling Ring, where these kids broke into her house and many other celebrities' houses and stole things. And when they made the film and the kids ended up in trouble, I don't want to spoil it because I think it's a great film, but she actually let them use her house in the movie. And you look, every picture, all of the pictures on the walls, all of the cushions are all her face, magazines she's been in, what have you, which is a little bit daunting. And she didn't notice that they'd been and stolen loads of her stuff, apparently.
Oh, that's like when the Manson family would go
creepy crawling.
Yeah, they'd just go around and move things and take a few things, and you'd come home and be like, am I going crazy?
So famous that there's even a book. Creepy crawling.
That's so scary.
But don't get me started. Isn't this interesting? Because when this program was run in China, it was called brainwashing. You know, the 1949-53 program, and that was reintroduced in Xinjiang, re-education thought reform. And when you look at the processes that are being utilize the procedures that they're following. They are very much ways of breaking and taming people. And that was my first metaphor when I left Scientology 40 years ago. And I'm sick and tired of people saying he's an ex-Scientologist. It's like, that's what I did with my life, you know. No, that's not who I am. That was, you know, and it, you know, for me, it was a reasonably okay experience. For most people, it isn't. But when I came out, I was trying to look for some model of what was happening. And it seemed very much that it was breaking and taming. That people were, you know, isolation, dependency and dread is one of the models. That you're being pushed to a point where you will give up control of yourself. And I think that's the worst possible thing you can do. I was in Washington, D.C. many a long year ago, and this cab driver, it was great fun. I was meant to be flying home from Washington Airport, and there were no flights, so you got a free cab drive to Baltimore to get a plane there. And so I was with my friend Ira Chaloff, and we stood there for about half an hour with no cabs of this Sky Blue company coming up, so I couldn't, because that's all I got a little ticket for. And this guy pulled over, and I got in the car, and he said, "Oh, do you mind if I stop for gas? Because this isn't my car, and we lose all the gas that we've put in. So I only keep a little bit in Baltimore. So is that okay?" So I said, "Yeah, that's fine." He said, "We've got plenty of time." And then he said, we drive another 2 minutes. He said, "Actually, I haven't had my lunch. Would you mind if I stopped, got some lunch? We've got plenty of time." So he stopped and got his lunch, you know. And he said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Oh, well, you know, I talk with people who've been involved in what are called cult groups, authoritarian groups." And he said, "Oh, you're the person I wanted to meet. Here, can we just take a little detour? We've got plenty of time." Oh, and he drove me down Martin Luther King Boulevard. And you've got Capitol Hill, you know, the most powerful institution in the world. And then you've got these slums all around it. And he said, "You know, look in the doorways. There are all these boarded up places with junkies sat in the doorways." And he said, "You see, I've been looking for somebody like you, because what I want to do is round all of these people up and put them in a boot camp. And then somebody like you can brainwash them into being good citizens." And that was where I had to give him the horrible truth that you cannot brainwash people into being good citizens. You have to unbrainwash them. You have to make them feel part of something, make them feel that they're contributing to something. And we see that. I think it was Mendota that there was a juvenile program there, and the control group got no help. What, you know, they got the normal juvie thing, but the other group got therapists and proper stuff, not this troubled teen nonsense. And in the follow up, something like 2 years later, the control group had, I think they'd committed 17 murders, whereas the ones that people have been nice to had committed none. And just that simple idea that, you know, in this country, when Margaret Thatcher was in power, she appointed William Whitelaw, and he brought in the short, sharp shock, which is a quotation from the Mikado, and it means execution by axe. But he thought it was a funny joke, where kids would go through this harsh military or militaristic experience, and reoffense rates shot up to 80% during this program.
Yeah.
In the kind of hippie early 70s, there's a place called Pepper Harrow, which was a reform school. And you got, like, I remember seeing a film of it, and you've got this 8-year-old walking around smoking a cigarette, and nobody's telling him off. And I'm like, this is getting a bit extreme. Their reoffense rate was 10%.
Wow.
And so there is now so much evidence that's piled up that if you are horrible to people, they will turn out horrible.
I think the word reoffending is really an important thing to contemplate with the troubled teen industry. Sorry, because a lot of the individuals I've spoken to, when I talk about, did you feel as if the troubled teen industry had solved any of the issues that you had going into this program? And the majority of people talk about going on to horrifically abuse substances and alcohol. A lot of their peers take their own lives. And there's no evidence to concretely say this is a direct result of or being sent to one of these programs. But there's a chance that the individual would not have become so severe with their addictions or behaviors or reactions to things had they not been subjected to this abuse. What comes with these types of environments, of course, is predatory behavior, sexual abuse, physical abuse. Individuals are dying in these programs. Taylor Goodridge lost her life a few months ago because she was sick. She was telling the staff that she was sick. They were telling her that she was trying to manipulate them, that she was going to be fine. Medical neglect is huge in these places. Dentistry, you know, injuries from the manual labor. A lot of the time, people don't want individuals to access hospitals or medical care because there's a chance that the abuses that they are being subjected to will be realized before the indoctrination process is complete. So what John Hunter talks about, that euphoric feeling that you get at the end of a program at graduation when you're handed your certificate, everybody celebrates you, your parents and guardians are crying because they're so proud of you because they think that you've been through this amazing journey without ever really knowing what's happened to you. And then there's a chance that when you do open up about it, there's this kind of confirmation bias, but look how well you turned out, or look how much good it did for you. And this can't be said for everybody because parents are misled, horribly misled, when it comes to what their children will be going through when they go to these places, and kind of coached step by step on what to believe and what not to believe. And I work quite closely with some parents who are going through their own lawsuits and legal action at the moment to kind of change at least, you know, insurance companies' decisions to insure these places by, you know, saying if you're going to continue to insure these places, then we're going to make sure you have no money left to insure them with, which is good. Unfortunately, there are a lot of parents that kind of say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's what you needed, or we did the right thing. And a lot of this kind of what people have said, burying your head in the sand kind of reaction to things. But the difficulty with a lot of these programs is the death rates, the suicide rates. And that's without just the isolation part. You know, there's so many different things to consider that might severely impact an individual for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. Some people have talked about not being able to listen to certain music because there's tracks that they play before or during, you know, as John Hunter said, with large group awareness training as well, it kind of like becomes this reactionary music that's played. So people know what to expect or what's expected of them. And it's something that stays with people for the rest of their lives if they, you know, if they continue living, which a lot of people don't. I have interviewed an author called Elizabeth Gilpin, who talked about so many of her peers taking their own lives after their experiences in one of these places because people don't know how to regulate emotions, have conversations without oversharing or becoming confrontational, don't have the coping skills to really manage substance addiction or alcoholism. So these places are just awful. And Taylor Goodrich ended up with a distended stomach on the mattress on her floor and died of septicemia. And I do believe that Diamond Ranch Academy for Girls is now closed down, but there was this really long battle between protesters and people who are like, let's just keep it open. But it is one of the places that has finally closed down. But there's so many where deaths have taken place. There was one where a really young girl, 6 or 7, was rolled up in like a carpet or a rug, and was her mother had to sit on her while she tried to wriggle out of this carpet. And it was supposed to be some type of exercise that is like a metaphor for rebirthing, and the child suffocated to death. So I mean, there's so many examples of this, and it's just horrific. The more you look into it, the worse it gets. But there is a positive moving tide at the moment with some type of change, legal change, and also individuals learning how to take these places to court, and attempt some type of justice in some way. But we'll see how things keep going.
It brings us back to your opening statement about, you know, what is a cult and what do we mean by that term. And for many years I kept rigidly to the Oxford dictionary definition, and I will always use the Oxford over any of the other dictionaries, because all of the other dictionaries are copies. The research work is done at Oxford, and Merriam-Webster probably have a little bit of research as well, but generally people look to the Oxford and say, oh, this word now means this. The word cult, according to the Oxford Dictionary, is a group that has a devotion to a leader or a doctrine. It came into use in the English language in the year, the first usage they have is 1711. And a perversion of this term belongs to the American Heritage Dictionary, which started to say that, you know, there was something pejorative about this, because it would be proper to say that Christianity is the Jesus cult. There's nothing negative in that statement. But the term cult, because of the use by some social scientists who've become upset about it, and by the media, it's moved on. So you're going, well, we're discussing something that is, you know, the cults we're concerned about are the destructive cults. It's not the notion of people following a doctrine or believing in a leader or a teacher. It's when it becomes harmful. The question I've most frequently been asked in the last 40 years is it a cult? Somebody comes up to me at a conference and they say, you know, my brother's involved in this, is it a cult? And my response is, has it done harm? Has this person changed in a negative way? Because, and I think that when we deal with brat camps, that this is, I, you know, what I've come to as the fundamental idea that we're dealing with in our society, which is authoritarianism. And for years, I, you know, along with most of my colleagues, I used the term totalitarian or totalist. And somewhere about 5 years ago, I sort of went, no, any kind of authoritarianism, totalitarianism, of course, is a portmanteau word. It's total authoritarianism. I think it was first used about Mussolini in the 1920s, and very true. He was a horrible, horrible man who, it would appear, raped usually 4 women a day. By rape, we mean a physical assault. You know, they would be left bruised, bleeding, and that's how he got his jollies. And so he proved to be quite an unpleasant human being. But this notion of totalitarianism, I kind of went, well, it doesn't matter if the authority is total. What is it in our society? And it's, you know, it comes up again and again. Schopenhauer, the philosopher, said about 60% of people do not become people. They never mature. Eric Fromm, in Escape from Freedom in 1941, said the reason Nazism rose in Germany, and he was there when it did, he had to run for his life in 1933. But the reason Nazism rose is because people do not develop a self. And he talked about the pseudo-self, where you're trying to placate the people around you. You're trying to have, you know, wear the Adidas or the Nike thing so that, you know, you'll be fitting in and all that stuff. So you don't develop a self. You're always waiting for somebody else to approve you. When Milgram did his studies where people were thought that people, they were giving electric shocks to people in the early 60s at Yale, you had this idea that, you know, he surveyed psychiatrists beforehand and they said, oh, about 1% of people will actually do what you ask. 62.5% of people went to the full extreme in the first of the 17 experiments. So He found that there is a tremendous willingness, and again, somewhere around 60% of people. More recently, Jane McGregor, who's at Nottingham University, and I really must contact her and talk to her. You'll probably get there first now. But she wrote a book about the sociopath, empath, apath triad. And her idea is that sociopaths recruit 60% of the population, it's that number again, it's magic number, to attack empaths. And it's why our society is out of balance, because our society is generally and has always generally been run by tyrants, by authoritarians, mm-hmm. by people who believe that their opinion is correct and that if people just do as they're told, then everything will be fine. And of course, if everything isn't fine, it's because they weren't doing what they were told. And then you have people who haven't developed enough to be able to make decisions or to feel that their decision is important. So they just go along. Robert J. Lifton's study of the Nazi doctors is terrifying in this regard. 45% of medical doctors in Germany and Austria and the Sudetenland joined the Nazi party. 45% of these highly educated people, at least 6 years in university to get to this point, put their lot in with this man who was not really very clever, had poor personal hygiene, and was a vegetarian, loved dogs and sugar. This whole idea, I feel this is the fundamental problem in our society, and I moved away from cult, you know, I mean, what's it called? We've lost that. To look at what my friend Christian Cherko calls extreme authoritarian sects. So a group that demands that its members do things without thinking. So I want my kids, I've got four kids, I want one of them all to grow up to become adults, to be responsible for themselves, to have their own goals and their own motivation. And that meant they started out when they were born, and you may have noticed this, being completely dependent. And the idea is that by the time they grow up, which is about the age of 35, by the time they grow up, they should be responsible for themselves. They should also want to contribute to the world. They should want to do good for other people. They should want to be part of a caring community. And unfortunately, we've got video games instead of that now. And
well, you also have groups that promise you can do those things, you know, contribute to the world and be a better person and all those things if you just join.
Yeah, if you just don't be an individual.
Yes, exactly.
And so, yeah, it's horrifying that children, you know, I believe children should have the same rights that adults do to not being traumatized, to not being threatened, to not being physically attacked. And so situations, you know, throughout history, there are these two simple views that if you're kind and caring towards people, they may develop to be kind and caring. Or if you brutalize people sufficiently, they'll be obedient. And as Oscar Wilde said, disobedience is man's original virtue. Smart bloke. And, you know, or my friend Ira, intelligent disobedience. Teach children to say, no, that's wrong. I'm not going to do it. Rather than this, you know, having to do as you're told. Encourage creativity. And conformity should be something that's only there so that society can progress, so that we can, instead of being, you know, if you don't wear, you know, this amulet or you know, a blue handkerchief or whatever, then God will send you to hell or have you. It becomes, and you know, the being in check is Robert J. Lifton's demand for purity, the idea that, you know, to belong to our group, you've got to do these things. I'm all for the individual, I'm all for eccentricity and difference, creativity, rather than, you know, fitting in and going and marching to the front line to be shot at. Never wanted to be shot at.
Yeah, but those things are no good for these types of groups. Of course, you know, conformity and lack of individualism are two things that are absolutely necessary in having a a productive, destructive cult. And this is something that is seen in the troubled teen industry hugely, you know, lack of individualism, no independent thought. But the authoritarianism that you're talking about, I believe I remember reading about in Opening Our Minds by this author called John Atack.
I think I've heard of him, yeah. I wouldn't trust a word he says, you know. I've met
the idea around the educational system for children having kind of, or well, it is an authoritarian environment. How much of that is needed? How much of it isn't? How much can it change to positively impact a child? And how much will it detract from a child's progress if it stays in a certain regimented way? I thought was really interesting, because somebody asked me once before I did a talk with Janja Lalić, I asked some people in my kind of little social media circle if they had any questions for a Q&A, and one person said, do you think schools are cults? And so when I was reading Opening Our Minds, that's kind of the question I was going back to, because it's something that I've been thinking about on and off ever since I heard that question. I don't think that I agreed with it, and I didn't know why until I read that passage in your book and worked out that that's actually what it was. It's authoritarianism that I was trying to kind of put in there.
And it is that thought, you know, a child is born completely dependent, but you should be going towards a point where they're independent. And so the more we force them to, I mean, you know, I was a tremendously rebellious teenager. I would certainly have ended up in a boot camp. No two ways about it. You know, I was a naughty boy, as is said of Brian in the life of Brian. I was not the Messiah. I was a naughty boy. And luckily, I had tolerant parents, and I didn't end up in the system, because, you know, it would have destroyed me. It would not have made me a better person. Now, hopefully what I've done, you know, and I'm retired now.
Retired.
Hopefully what I've done in the last 40 years has been useful to society. And I wouldn't have been any use at all if I'd been, you know, traumatized and, you know, by these horrible systems. So it is, you know, how do we create a situation where the individual, where a child can develop to be the most they can be and to be of the most use to society? And I do think, I got very interested in one of the things, I got very interested in a few things over the years. One of the things I got interested in was, because I grew up through the hippie era, you know, and at the age of 14, had sort of 15, had shoulder length hair. Saw Jimi Hendrix at the Isle of Wight as well. It was very good. Fell asleep.
Oh, but I'm going to tell my partner. He'll be so jealous.
I was in a shop in the village here a couple of years ago, and this guy, out of nowhere, he said, "The thing I most regret is that I didn't see Jimi Hendrix at the Isle of Wight." And I said, "Well, I did, actually." And I said, "Why didn't you go?" He said, "I was only 3 years old." So I said, "What mean parents?" You know, I mean, huh?
Yeah, could have been a first core memory for that guy.
Yeah, nearly everybody fell asleep because he was so late coming on, and it spent two hours getting the sound right and what have you. There is a very good recording of it called Wild Blue Angels. But, you know, I had that hippie experience, and I met American hippies, and I was really interested that they seem so different. And the difference, you know, a few years ago, I got into this, you read around it and what have you. Steve Kent's Slogans and Mantras is quite interesting on, you know, how cults came out of the dissolution of and the disillusion of the hippie movement.
Yeah, so many cults, just so many of them.
It all exploded in the 70s, you know, probably because after the Sorbonne sit-in and the Days of Rage in Chicago, the hippies realized that the establishment was going to kill them. And there wasn't a viable way of changing the world. I would say the Green Movement is a successor to the hippie movement and something positive that came out of so much idleness and dope smoking. Not there's anything wrong with idleness. I do it myself at times. I sometimes sit down for minutes on end without doing anything. But the significant difference when I came to it was they had a very public war in Vietnam. Now, most people who live in this country don't realize that we had a war on the same scale in Malaysia and Borneo, but we didn't draft people into the army. So, and I think that the trauma of sending hundreds of thousands of young people to fundamentally kill people who've just trying to rescue their own country from oppression and invasion, that really twisted the American psyche. That it came on the heels, of course, of Korea, where, you know, who knows anything about Korea anymore? It's North Korea's horrible and South Korea's industrial. And, you know, there will be fire and fury if anybody does anything to Donald Trump. North Korea didn't have a single town left standing in 1953. Every town was bombed flat. And this, why do they resent Westerners? Huh. Who knows?
Yeah.
So if you keep inflicting trauma through warfare and you keep bringing people back into the society who have post-traumatic stress disorder, then something quite serious might happen. And I think that having a generation that grows up with less trauma, not being sent to brat camps or off to Southeast Asia to kill people, that of itself is going to be significant to a society. And, you know, I think the law is changing around the world about being allowed to hit children. I've Sandy Toksvig, the TV personality, I will never forget this. She was said, of course, there are people who say you shouldn't hit children. They're just being dishonest. It's like, okay, I've got four kids. I've never hit a child in my life. I've never felt it necessary. They're little. I don't need to hit them. They're smaller than me. You know? If I need to contain them, I can. And there's always a way through it. But that, I think if you believe, and it's sometimes that, you know, this silly notion, L. Ron Hubbard used to say, man is basically good. Carl Rogers, the very interesting Carl Rogers, the great therapist, he sat down with, what's his name, the rabbinical scholar, the I Thou guy. He sat down with him and he said, I think you'd agree with me. Martin, somebody or other, I think you'd agree with me, Martin, that man is basically good. And this guy looked at him and he said, yeah, man is basically good and evil.
Yeah.
And I think you have people who think that we're evil, born in sin and have to be controlled puritanically in some way. And they will just pass on their own discomfort and displeasure at life, generation on generation. Then there are people who get a bit too hippie and think, you know, everybody's basically good. I think the reality is, you know, about 2% of people are psychopaths, 3% of men, only 1% of women. You've got to try harder. And those people
better at hiding it from people.
Well, it said that it inverts with the borderline personality, 3% women, 1% men. But there you go. I think that's horrid, saying nasty things about women. But there are a very small percentage of people who are deeply unpleasant. And I don't think we should be deeply unpleasant to them. I don't think that's helpful. But I do think we should identify them and keep them from harming people to the extent we can. You know, I think when Charles Manson in 1967 got to the prison gate and said, I don't want to leave, please keep me, they should have kept him. You know, he was right about that. But then you've got a huge mass of people who really don't know what's going on, that 60%, who haven't fully developed a self. They don't feel confident in themselves. I wrote a novel called Voodoo Child's Slight Return, in which I brought Jimi Hendrix back to life. Because I thought, he died 18 days after I saw him. I don't think it was my fault, but
wow,
what a rotten thing to do to us, this brilliant man.
Mm-hmm.
And at the center of the novel is a simple idea, which is, I believe that everybody has talent. I believe that everybody, you know, no matter what's going on with them, there's something they can do. And as yet, I mean, Will Rogers said he'd never met a man he didn't like. I've met quite a few men I didn't like, actually. So you can keep that. But I've never met anybody, never yet met anybody who didn't have something to teach me, whether from their insight or from their experience. And allowing people to develop, getting people to develop, getting people to be creative and contribute something, helping people to understand that their rights are important, that their opinions yeah. are important, and getting them to develop the notion of discussing things rather than hitting people, you know, which is, I think there is so much that can be done that isn't being done.
Yeah. I agree. And I often wonder what would life be like or would have been like for like Bobby Fischer or Magnus Carlsen had they never sat down in front of a chessboard, or Jimi Hendrix never picked up a guitar, you know? And I wonder, you know, Roger Federer never played tennis. How do these people find that they have this level of talent for a specific thing? And how many of us have a similar level of talent for something that we just haven't accessed? And it's quite scary to think about that, because these are people that are considered geniuses in their respective art field, sport. So it's quite overwhelming to think that there is something that people could be equally talented at. Although I do believe that there are some exceptions that where people are just incredible in a way that other people couldn't be. I don't know. Yeah. Jimi Hendrix is like one in a few million, I imagine.
Maybe a few billion. He was 14 when his dad came home and gave him a guitar, and he'd bought a saxophone for himself, which he didn't learn to play. And this was a kid who'd not had shoes, and they're living in Seattle. This isn't down in the deep south or something. This is a very cold place in the winter, and they were so poor. And Louis Armstrong, you know, one of the other incredibly influential people, perhaps probably more influential even than Hendrix, who, you know, you can't play the electric guitar without being influenced by Jimi Hendrix. It's not no. possible. But the same, you know, when you look to jazz and the origins of jazz, Armstrong invents scat singing, his trumpet playing, you know, Wynton Marsalis, I think it's called West End Blues, and in Ken Burns' jazz, Marsalis, who's incredible trumpet player, plays this thing, and he says, this is the benchmark. If you're a trumpet player, you have to learn to play this. It's not, you know, a Mozart piece or anything. It's Louis Armstrong. And he was he was in a reform school, but nicely treated, apparently. Whenever he went back to New Orleans, he used to go back to the home and lie on the bed there where he'd, and at 11 he started working for a coal merchant delivering coal, and Jewish family, and they really liked him, and they said, we want to give you something. And he pointed in a window, and there was a cornet, and he said, I want that. And they said he just picked it up and played it.
It gives me goosebumps. Like, I love these stories of people, but what would have happened had that exchange never taken place? It's so strange to think about.
Yeah, I mean, he and Sidney Bechet they're the beginning of jazz as we have it. And you know, Duke Ellington said he had an 11-man orchestra. He said he just wanted Louis Armstrong to play every instrument in the orchestra. But even if it's not that, you know, incredible level of genius, of talent, everybody has some things they can do. With some people, you know, it might be embroidery, it might be knitting, it might be cooking, it might be something in the garden, but it's finding out what suits your talent. I had a situation many years ago where a young man was introduced to me who'd just come out of a reform school. This is day to talk about reform schools. And he was making a precarious living so that he could score whatever it was he wanted by stealing car radios. And I pointed out to him that this probably wasn't going to be the way ahead. And to my amazement and delight, over the next year, he stopped nicking car radios. he discovered jazz. He'd been listening to Cabaret Voltaire before then, not the Hugo Ball Tristan Zara one in Switzerland, but the bloody awful noise band. And, you know, smoking way too much of a certain substance. And he turned around, he went to college, he learned double bass, he got into Dexter Gordon and all sorts of jazz stuff. And he got a job as a gardener at Shugborough Hall for Lord Lichfield. And the transformation from this troubled teen, 18 years old when I met him, through over the next few years to him finding a purpose and a meaning in his life and celebrating that, it was a delight to see. It was sort of, you know, this is what should be happening. What is the motivation you have? What would you love to do? You know, I think Joseph Campbell with his simple statement, follow your bliss. Mm-hmm. You know, find some place in your life to do something that rewards you. Campbell told this story frequently about sitting in a diner one day and hearing a young man say to his father that he didn't want to drink his orange juice. And the father said, I've never done a thing in my life that I wanted to do. And there's the problem. You know, so, you know, teaching people that they are valuable and that they should be allowed to achieve something, whether it's the, you know, stellar performance of Satchmo or Jimi Hendrix, you know, that very few people are going to do that, but they might be able to make a very nice Dutch apple cake.
Ooh, mm-hmm.
And as long as it's gluten free, I'm there.
I think there's a lot in what you've said, and it's hard to, I mean, it's in some ways it's kind of idealistic, because you wonder how you can make that possible for every young person in certain circumstances, you know, extremely impoverished households. You know, someday some kid's dad might not be able to come home with a guitar. And I wonder how...
Well, he sold the saxophone.
Well, yeah, sold the saxophone. So that helps. But maybe he was destined to be the world's greatest saxophonist. But it's difficult, because we've talked about authoritarianism. We've talked about this very small percent of the world population being awful people. Mm. You know, there's children growing up with parents that are within that percentage, or guardians that are within that percentage, mm. and people that are groomed for gangs, and kids that live in areas where there's nothing to do, and so they end up in trouble. You know, I grew up in a seaside town, and there was nothing for children to do. Everything was boarded up, and you know, juvenile detention.
You just
rates.
Got tired of going paddling every day, eh?
Well, we went on sunny days. The beach was perfect. You'd stay there for 10, 12 hours a day when you were a kid. I thought about this the other day as well, because there was a news story about a kid, like a 12-year-old child, who had gotten a lighter and an aerosol can with a group of friends and ended up with third degree burns all over his body. And the mother took to social media to say that, you know, her son had always been sensible, had never, you know, had never, as far as she knew, played with fire and things like that before. And it just goes to show that, you know, you can tell your kids over and over not to do these things, but the chances are that when it comes to risk taking, they're probably going to try and do these things at some point. I don't know how much truth there is to it. I probably did stupid things when I was growing up as well.
I can't imagine that, Casey.
Well, you said that we become adults at 35. I'm only 30. I've got 5 years to do stupid things.
Plenty of time. Don't set fire to yourself, though, eh?
But when we were on the beach as kids, it didn't matter what lifeguard flags were out. We always followed the rules of the lifeguards without any adult telling us what to do. You know, if the red flags were out, we never went in the water. And I just think that's such a strange thing. I don't know if it's because we knew that children had, you know, got caught on the sandbanks and had passed away, or were never found again. You know, they used to have an air show that came to our town every year. And one year they always do these things where the planes go really close to the water and then suddenly come back up. But one year this Harrier jump jet just going down, and all of a sudden we just see this little guy flying up in the air, and the plane crashed in the water. And there's like hundreds of thousands of people on this beach. Everything just goes dead silent. The tannoy, like the guy that's like doing over the speakerphone, isn't saying anything. This huge wave comes out. And then for months and months after that, there's just parts of this plane washing up on the beach.
We just
I don't
threw
know
away
how.
this million-pound plane. Yay!
Yeah, like it was like of its version, it was like one of three left, like in the country or something. So it was, yeah, it was all over the news for ages. But we always used to say, like, one day a plane will go in the water, and then one year it did. So it was just a quite a spectacle to behold. We were just paddling in the water as well. And but it's interesting that as children we just never did that, go in the water when, you know, because we get basking sharks as well. So we'd get shark flags, you know, can't go in the water because the basking sharks, which like the biggest type of shark, but they're like bottom feeders, so they don't actually eat people, but they could just swallow you whole. So they're just, I never saw one, but yeah, shark flags, sandbanks. But in those types of towns where there's nothing for children to do, I mean, we had a couple of youth clubs that tried really hard, but it was the highest teenage pregnancy town in the whole country at one point. And the juvenile detention rates were sky high for the rest of in terms of the rest of England. And I think that just shows like there has to be some type of prosperity.
Well,
Otherwise,
yeah.
children aren't going to realize their potential. They're just going to end up doing what they can to not be bored. And most of the time, that turns out to be stuff that's going to get you hurt, arrested, pregnant, or maybe all three.
The same time. Yeah, one of the things that I got very interested in gang culture, not as a participant, and I read about the Scuttlers. You know about the Scuttlers?
I don't, but
Okay.
I mean,
Well,
did you not want to join a gang just to do kind of first-hand research?
it's probably a little bit late for me by the time I was doing it, you know, because I was what, in my 40s, but I could still try. I mean, and there are some incredible things that happened, you know, during that research. I met a Spanish policeman from Barcelona. And at a conference, and he was incredible. I'm trying to remember what the gang are called, but a gang had suddenly started arriving, and I think they were from Ecuador originally, and they then come through the US. And basically, you've got these two gangs, and their whole purpose in life is to kill each other. And so this guy was given the job of dealing with this. And he was a lateral thinker, and this is, you know, so he went to the US and saw how the gangs functioned there, went to prison there, and went, he couldn't believe the way the prisons functioned. It was just disgusting the way that they were treating these people. And then he went down, I think it was Ecuador, and there it was just unbelievable that they were treated as vermin. And so that's what he got hold of. He went there not being offered respect. And what do they call this? Something Kings. It'll come back to me. I read a book about it that one of them wrote as well. But this is a long time ago, and I'm a very old person. So when he got back, he had the two leaders of the gangs arrested at 6 in the morning. They were taken to the police station. They were put in a room together, and he went into the room and he said, by the end of the day, you're going to have reached an agreement whereby when you are in Spain, you do not kill each other. And as long as you do that, we will not harm you. By the time I met him, he'd traveled all over the world being asked, how on earth did you manage to do this? You know, so that thing. But I was going to tell you about the Scuttlers. Now, if you go to Salford, and I know there's a possibility of that, this is where the Scuttlers were. In the 18, 70s, there every Saturday night, there'd be about 500 youths between the ages of 13 and 25 out on the streets fighting. There's a book called Gangs of Manchester about it.
Yeah, I was just thinking about hooliganism feels kind of kin to that.
Well, hooliganism is exactly the same time. The hooligans are coming up the railway lines, getting off of villages and terrorising them with their, knobbly belts and things. In fact, where I live in near Nottingham, we have what was a police station. It's now a lawyer's office, but it was built in 1871, the year after the railroad came through, for exactly that reason. And of course, the British police force comes into being, the National Police Force at that time, to deal with the problem of the hooligans. But the scuttlers, firstly, age 13 to 25, they'd be the breadwinners in their families, because past 25, you were often physically broken from the kind of work that you were subjected to. In these street fights, people were killed, bones were broken, they used belt buckles and chains and, a bit like Peaky Blinders, really, but on a much bigger scale. And this problem, this terrible and overwhelming problem, disappeared. And the reason it disappeared was the youth club movement, that both the Anglican and the Methodist Church, before they got into sexual abuse in a big way, both the Anglican and Methodist Church set up these places where kids could get together, play games, do stuff. So some kind of, now we have video games, so we don't need to think about anything anymore. They can just...
leave the house.
I found that my youngest kids, when they were 6 and 8 years old, somebody had sat, an adult had sat them down and allowed them to play Grand Theft Auto. 6 and 8. And when I found out about it and said to this man, "What?" He said, "That was 6 months ago." So that was all right, apparently. Why?
No, I used to work with young carers aged 6 to 18. And if the 10 to 12 year olds wanted to tell me what video games they were playing and then start to talk to me about Call of Duty, I'd tell them that I didn't want to hear anything about it.
Yeah.
I'd be like, "I've played Call of Duty, but when you're over the age of 18, which is, I believe, the age that you need to be to legally play that game, you can come and tell me." And they'd be like, "Oh, but come on, let me tell you about Call of Duty. I'm so good at it." And I was like, "I bet you are."
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah. Yeah. So I agree with you. It's idealistic, but I think I differ from most of the people I know in that I do believe that we have all the tools we need to make a good society. If, if we could stop wasting so much on warfare, and, that the Iraq war cost $1 million dollars. Now, if you poured that into, the places where there's poverty, and you use that to create justice systems that function and dig out corruption, if you used it to get basic education in, I'm really not sure about most of the stuff kids are learning in school. It seems to not really lodge with most people that their geography and their algebra won't necessarily be useful to them. So if we look towards teaching kids how to communicate, how to resolve disputes, how to express your opinion, how to be assertive rather than aggressive, all sorts of things that are not in the curriculum. We've got stuff about bullying, and I think that, another problem, there was a surgeon a few years ago, an expert, who'd come to the end of his career. And he published this book saying that what a terrible shame it was that drama and the arts, music, were dropping out of our educational system, because if you want to be a good surgeon, these are very useful. Having some kind of creative intelligence actually makes you better at what you do. And this kind of blinkered approach to education where universities are Well, I'm not impressed. What can I say? My experience with universities is, their standards are awful and they're ripping the students off blind, you know.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, John, because I am a graduate of the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts. So my background is actually in the arts and the theatre. And just as I was graduating from university, they changed the curriculum nationally so that music, dance, drama, and art were no longer mandatory subjects in school. I think that now you choose one of the four disciplines. And it gives me like goosebumps to think about it because I struggled with things like maths, and science, but I thrived when I had the opportunity to be involved in any type of artistic subject. And I never would have gone to the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts. I mean, if there wasn't such a focus of arts in my life, I wouldn't even be sitting in this room right now because I never would have moved up to Liverpool. I never, if music didn't have such an influence on people, Paul McCartney would have never opened that school to begin with. So, it kind of comes full circle, but it was really devastating for me to hear that was the government's decision because I think of all the kids in education that would be struggling with certain subjects in the way that I did, and for them to never have the access to those types of experiences in school that might really resonate them with them is really tough. And my background is specifically in applied theatre, so it's working with underprivileged, marginalized community groups that are perhaps underrepresented for various reasons, whether it's ethnicity, whether it's, I worked with people at Old Course Prison. I worked with a group of male inmates, just using different types of art thought forms as a way to resolve conflict or to think about the main session title was reoffending. So it was just looking at reasons why, preventative measures or maybe trying to get to the kind of heart of the real reasons why individuals might feel the need to reoffend, whether it's because they're pressured by gangs, for example, or taking the heat for other people, whatever the reason was. And I found with this group of big burly men who were just not interested in taking part in anything at first, by the end of these sessions, we decided that we were going to end by doing an adaptation of Oliver, and they were all fighting over who was going to play the role of Nancy. So it was very slow facilitation classes, very slow, non-invasive kind of person-centered. Whatever you want to do, you can do it. This is the aim. You don't have to be here. You could go back to your cell. Not a great option, but by the end of it had become clear that there were some tools that were developed through those facilitation classes that individuals were using. They were journaling, bringing me diary entries that I hadn't asked anybody to do, and I think it just shows you that there are so many different types of community groups that you can work with, that you can use facilitation with, and various different art forms. I've worked with a deaf community around kind of sensory development and enjoying music without having the ability to hear. Oh, it was just such a beautiful experience because there was one guy who was deaf and also partially blind. And he was holding on to these speakers and he was listening to this music for the first time. And it was just the most incredible experience. And I just think it's such a shame that so much of that will be lost going forward because there's such a lack of emphasis and accessibility to those types of things under our current curriculum. And so many individuals that I've spoken to on the podcast talk about how imperative various art forms have been to their recovery from various abuses and environments that they've lived in. So that's me off my soapbox.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a drummer, so of course I know about Evelyn Glennie, who's the deaf percussionist, and incredible, just absolutely amazing. And I do believe, even if we looked at it from an economic perspective, it was both Labour and Tories are guilty. Jim Callaghan in the 70s decided he was going to close art colleges, and Margaret Thatcher just carried on doing it. And you start adding up and you start going, well, let's look at what the art school graduates or dropouts did. John Lennon, 10cc, Pink Floyd, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, Sandy Denny. And you look at the huge amount of money that these people, it was said in, I went to art college, and it was said that 1 in 8,000 students would have a career as a painter. And so we'll stop doing it. And you go, yeah, how many of them had careers where they earned so much money that they'd pay for the other 8,000? That when you look at how much money the Beatles made. And it bringing everything down to chemistry, biology, mathematics, it's all good fun. But just that, I think the whole set, that's a whole, it's another conversation about what we should be studying at school, and the idea that there are different subjects. Because as far as I'm concerned, there is only philosophy. There is only the integration of these ideas, so that if you want, I find that I'll learn, I'll learn something if I can integrate it into the matrix of my existing information. And so fragmenting everything and saying history is different to English, and you're going, well, why don't we look at
The history of
something?
the English language.
Yeah, why don't we take a particular, look at George Eliot or Jane Austen or something, and look at the history of the time and see how that happened. Look at the costume, look at the fashion, which I think is a lot more important than people realize, that we're all, you see how desperately people are trying to fit in. I sat with a woman who was, I think she was the head of Trent University's fashion department, which also has an offshoot in Paris. I had dinner with her years ago, lovely woman. And she was saying, I know that what I do really has no meaning. And I was sort of, no, it has incredible meaning. A tremendous amount of people feel better. I shop at the charity store because it's all I can afford. But nonetheless, I do like it when I pick up an Austin Reed shirt for £4.50 and can go prancing around like a peacock and nobody takes any notice. But there you go.
You feel better.
Yeah, and the whole thing of a feeling that you can do something creative. I remember seeing this thing. It was a group of women, and they'd go to the cinema once a month or something all together, and they all sit and knit. And it was just such a sense of community, but
We have a little group around here, and I don't know who they are or where they are, but apparently it's a group of women that get together and they decorate our post boxes with these
yeah.
hats,
Oh
and
yeah,
they've got
we've
little
got that.
scenes on the top of, and sometimes I go to the bottom of my road and there'll be an Easter one or there'll be a Christmas nativity one, and I just think it's the most amazing thing.
Yeah,
They never get taken. People just, I think they just, yeah, it's like they're like a crowning jewel of the town.
and it, yes. So if anybody out there is watching, please knit tea cozies for post
Yeah,
boxes,
post
and
boxes, it
we'll
really
know
makes
our
my
work is
day.
done. Great. Well, we probably better wane. We've waxed enough. Now we'd better wane, but not wanetta. And this has been in great fun as ever, and we'll do it again in a little while. And go and find the Cult Vault if you haven't. We all need lots more
It's
subscribers.
available on all podcast platforms and a little channel on YouTube. And I'm going to be giving some regular updates on my Salford course as I go forward. So if anybody's interested in learning more about what's going to be happening there, then I'll be filling people in as I go. So
So
probably
this is this
crying and
the master.
stressed.
This is a master's degree in the psychology of coercive control with Rod and Linda Dubrow Marshall, my dear friends, who I've known for more than a decade now. Yeah, it should be good, and we'll see how you get along, and do what we can to make the world a better place.
Yes, and I appreciate you, John, and your time today, and for inviting me back on this very, very hot Monday evening.
It has been. And when it goes out now on a Wednesday or some other day of the week, people are going, it isn't Monday. What are they thinking? Yeah. Have they been brainwashed into a cult? You know,
great. Maybe we're just trying to gaslight people, make them feel crazy so they have to go and check their calendars.
Yeah.
Is it a Monday? Is it a Sunday?
We actually recorded
the beans
this.
Go out tonight?
We recorded this in 1927.
We did. We had access to great camera quality.
We did for the time, yeah. For the time. Great. Thank you
Thanks,
so much, Casey.
John. Take care. Bye.
See you, bye.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon. Or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much. We're going to do this show ASMR.